ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 26th of March. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. For the first time, the United Nations Security Council has passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The United States stood aside from the vote. Israel is furious. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has immediately cancelled a trip to Washington by two of his top advisers. For more on this, I spoke earlier with the ABC's Middle East correspondent, Alison Horne. Alison, how significant is the United Nations Security Council resolution?
Well, Sabra, it's the first time supporters of a ceasefire in Gaza have had a resolution like this passed through the Security Council. They have tried three times before since the war started in October last year, but each time it's been vetoed by the United States. But today the US has abstained from the vote, meaning the resolution has passed unopposed by any other council members. The resolution itself calls for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza for the month of Ramadan, which we're halfway through at the moment. And it also demands that that pause will lead to a lasting, sustainable ceasefire. It also demands the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages being held in Gaza. Now, resolutions passed at the Security Council are considered legally binding, but in practice, they're not always followed. So Israel can choose to not abide by this resolution, which will likely be the case, although it is facing massive international pressure to implement the resolution. Hamas says it welcomes the resolution and that it stands ready to return hostages in exchange for Palestinian detainees in Israel. But Israel says the vote hurts the country's war effort. And the foreign minister here has said that the fighting in Gaza will continue until hostages have been returned.
And the United States' decision to abstain from voting in this resolution has caused more friction, though, between Israel and Washington. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Israel seems to be lashing out of the United States. They wanted the US to use its veto power to shut down that resolution. And a high-level delegation of Israeli officials was meant to travel to the US this week for talks with Washington about Israel's planned ground invasion into the southern Gazan city of Rafah. But after this Security Council vote, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has actually cancelled that delegation trip. Mr. Netanyahu says the failure of the US to veto the resolution was a, in his words, clear retreat from its previous position. Now, that's something the White House has denied. They say that this vote doesn't represent a shift in policy. They are disappointed the delegation is no longer happening. But Sabra, I think this signifies a few things. There's obviously enormous political pressure that the United States is facing, both for its role in the war and for its backing of Israel as tens of thousands of Gazans are being killed. It's also more evidence of the deepening fractures between these two allies. But I think one thing that it also signifies is that here, locally, there's a bit of domestic politics going on. Benjamin Netanyahu here has to feel like he needs to be seen to be standing up to America.
Alison Horne reporting there. In the United States, Donald Trump's been given a financial lifeline with an appeals court ruling he can pay a significantly reduced bond in a civil fraud case in New York. In a separate legal case, a decision has gone against the former president. So his criminal hush money trial will now begin in mid-April. North America correspondent Barbara Miller joined me a short time ago. Barb, let's start with the civil fraud case. Donald Trump had been facing the possibility that these assets could be seized. Is he out of danger now?
It certainly looks like it. He had been due to pay $700 million by today. Now, this was after the finding against him in the civil fraud case, a finding that he had exaggerated the worth of his properties over many years in order to obtain favourable loan and insurance terms. And what could have started to happen from today was that his assets could have been seized. That would include cash, personal property, his planes, his cars, and then parts of his real estate empire. The appeals court has significantly reduced the amount he has to pay down to $270 million and said he had a further 10 days to make that payment. And Donald Trump, speaking today in New York after he knew about that, indicated that he would indeed make that payment and make it quickly.
And his first criminal trial is now set to start in mid-April. Is that date likely to stick?
That's right. He had a hearing and he attended that hearing in the criminal case. That's about the way that hush money payments to the former adult film star Stormy Daniels were accounted for. Now, that trial initially was supposed to start today, but the judge had agreed to a delay because tens of thousands more documents were discovered or were handed over to the defense in that case. And Donald Trump's lawyers had been asking for a significant delay in the case. The judge did not agree to that. And he has, as you say, said that this case will now go ahead in mid-April. Now, Donald Trump was not at all happy about that. Reporters in court said he was sort of scornful, shaking his head. And speaking following that ruling, he repeated his claims that his political opponents were targeting him.
A lot of things happened today. This is all about election interference. This is all Biden-run things, meaning Biden and his thugs, because I don't know if he knows he's alive. And it's a shame. It's a shame what's happening to our country. This is election interference.
Now, the significance, of course, of that case, Sabra, this would be the first of four criminal trials he's facing to actually begin. And given the way the others are going, it's possible it could be the only one that's able to take place before November's election. It's expected to take about 6 weeks in total, and jury selection expected to begin on that day, April the 15th.
Barbara Miller reporting there. For millions of Australians, loyalty programs with the big two supermarkets have been a way to reduce the impact of cost of living increases. But there are warnings the huge amount of data being collected by Coles and Woolworths is being used to stifle competition and squeeze suppliers. David Chen reports.
If you shop at one of the big two supermarkets, chances are you'll be asked this.
You have a Coles app or Flybuys card?
For millions of Australians, including mother of four, Tammy Irons, supermarket loyalty programs have helped to keep costs down.
I appreciate being able to bank that $10 each, you know, when it gets up to that level. And by the time I get to Christmas, I've got around $150 or so off my shop, which I really appreciate at Christmas time.
With about 85% of Australians belonging to at least one loyalty program, every purchase they make offers a treasure trove of data for Coles and Woolworths. Kate Bauer from the consumer group Choice says that's stifling competition.
Basically, they can use that information to set prices. Sometimes that can mean better prices for consumers, but sometimes it can also mean worse prices for consumers. But more importantly, it can also push smaller players out of the market.
Choice says the information allows the two big supermarkets to set prices that their competitors can't match and do targeted advertising to get consumers into their stores. Small business owner Damon Atkinson runs an online service selling produce direct from the farm gate just outside of Toowoomba in southern Queensland. He says the data trove gives the supermarket giants more leverage than producers.
Sometimes we see produce on their shelf as cheap as what we can buy it for.
Farming groups from across the country say the loyalty programs are also giving Coles and Woolworths greater power over fruit and vegetable growers. They've called on a Senate inquiry into the supermarkets to investigate the impact of big data on the sector. Rachel Chambers is the CEO of Queensland Fruit and Vegetable Growers.
You've got the supermarkets with all the information on supply and all the information on demand, and the growers having no information besides their own supply and no information besides a guesstimate. Where it gets really, really unfair is the perishability of these items, which makes negotiation completely on a different playing field. So you've got growers who have already taken all the risk. They have paid all the bills to this point, now at the peril of the buyers who now their first job is to get the item for as cheap as possible.
Producers and consumer advocates also want more regulation to better protect data from being shared with third parties. In statements provided to the ABC, Woolworths says it's standard practice for businesses to look at previous sales to help predict future demand and that it's investing millions of dollars in advertising to promote Australian produce. Coles says it uses data to inform its ordering requirements to ensure produce is available to customers at any given time and at affordable prices.
David Chen reporting there. As the Federal Treasurer prepares the government's third budget in May, the early childhood care sector is calling for the government to consider supporting a wage increase for educators. Yesterday, the government said it would push for a pay increase for Australia's low-paid workers in line with inflation as part of its submission to the annual wage review to the Fair Work Commission. But childcare advocates say a meaningful increase for early educators is long overdue. Political reporter Chantelle El-Khoury has this report.
As a childcare operator of one of the cheapest centres in Canberra, Nishi Puri sees firsthand the impact of low wages on her staff and the industry.
Childcare educators are very underpaid and underrated. So yes, they definitely need a wage increase because at this moment there's an acute shortage of childcare workers.
She says that increase needs to come from government coffers because previous staff wage increases have hurt already struggling parents.
The parents have been penalised all the while we did a fee increase each year for our educators, so, which is not fair for them because everybody's under the cost of living pressures, and I think federal government should step in.
Georgie Dent is the executive director of advocacy group The Parenthood. She says the early childhood education sector is experiencing the highest number of staff vacancies on record, and educators are among the lowest paid in Australia.
Early childhood educators have been leaving in record numbers over the last couple of years, and it is because a lot of them have said quite literally they can't afford to stay because the wages are so low and with the cost of living crisis that they're facing.
She says boosting their wages also helps improve the wider economy.
More than 90% of the early childhood education and care workforce is made up of women. So we know that a wage correction to see those educators and teachers being paid appropriately is going to meaningfully improve the financial security of women employed in that area.
Georgie Dent applauds recent federal government reforms of the childcare sector, but is taking the reform to boost educators' wages to politicians in Canberra today. Yesterday, the government said it will ask the Fair Work Commission to increase the minimum wage in line with inflation. The peak body for unions says that's not enough. The Australian Council of Trade Unions is calling for a 5% increase instead. Secretary Sally McManus.
If you take inflation into account, then you've got to think about award wage workers have gone backwards, and so they need to start catching up so that their wages recover to where they were 3 years ago before the pandemic. So it's essentially inflation plus catch up.
The Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry is arguing for a 2% increase, saying it will be too costly for businesses. Sally McManus says that's not enough for the 2.9 million lowest paid workers in the country.
They're the hardest hit by inflation. They don't have anywhere to go when their rent goes up, when their grocery prices and their bills go up. They have already had to cut back significantly and are the ones suffering the most.
ACTU Secretary Sally McManus ending that report by Chantelle El-Khoury. Youth housing services say a partial solution to the youth homelessness crisis is at the federal government's fingertips. It's $1 billion that's been set aside for housing. Advocates say nearly 40,000 children and young people came to them for help last year in finding somewhere to live, with nearly half remaining homeless. The groups are meeting with the government today to ask for the money to build more than 2,000 homes specifically for young people. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
Every year, thousands of children seek help from Melbourne City Mission.
They're often escaping violence, neglect, homophobia, and MCM is the largest youth refuge provider in Victoria, and our refuges are full every night, and these children and young people are being told over and over again that there is just no housing for them.
That's the mission's head of policy, advocacy and government relations, Shauna Moore. She says with nowhere left to turn, children and young people are left in dangerous situations.
At MCM, we're seeing young people experiencing significant mental health crisis as a result of their homelessness. We're seeing high rates of physical and sexual abuse as a result of their homelessness, self-harm, and sadly, suicide among this group as well.
So why is it so difficult to house young people? Wendy Hayhurst is the CEO of the Community Housing Industry Association. She says most young people applying for social housing are receiving youth allowance payments, much less than adults on JobSeeker.
What that means is it costs more to house young people than someone who's getting
job seeker. So generally they lose out.
Which puts housing providers in a tricky position.
When we're looking at building homes and we're working out how much it's going to cost, if we're just housing young people or housing a lot of young people in a development, we're going to need more subsidy, more assistance from government. There just isn't enough rent to cover all of the repairs and maintenance and management and paying back the bank.
When the Albanese government made a deal with the Greens to pass the Australia Future Fund, an additional $1 billion was put into something called the National Housing Infrastructure Facility. Wendy Hayhurst and other advocates are meeting with politicians today to request that money be allocated to youth housing.
The benefits of doing so are enormous. If we can give them stable housing and put the support in, they rarely come back to us once their programs are finished.
And modelling by Dr. Lawrence Troy at the University of Sydney shows it's enough to build 2,090 homes, housing more than 4,000 young people.
So we're kind of assuming a bit of an average here. We did the modelling around producing, say, 60% of it within an urban context, then the other 40% into a regional context.
In a statement to the ABC, the Minister for Homelessness, Julie Collins, said the government will continue to work hard to ensure our ambitious housing reform agenda is working across the board.
Elizabeth Cramsey reporting. It's been months since the Disability Royal Commission and review into the National Disability Insurance Scheme made hundreds of recommendations to radically improve the way services and supports are rolled out, run and regulated. And the community has had time now to digest those proposals, and many are now asking what happens next. A major conference starting today will give people a chance to further flesh out the proposals. And as National Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella explains, the issue of whether to shut groups' homes will be one of the hot topics.
It's taken decades for Diane Hilda's son Tristan to find a home of his own. He was born with an intellectual disability and at the age of 17, with no funding to support him and escalating behaviours, he could no longer live in the family home. When his mother reached out for help to find him suitable housing, she didn't realise they were about to enter the darkest period of their lives.
When Tristan left my care, Tristan was not on any medication at all. Over that 12-year period, Tristan became so psychiatrically unwell. He experienced a lot of trauma. He was assaulted.
During that time, Tristan was placed in more than 40 types of accommodation, including state care, boarding houses and group homes. His mother says all of them were inappropriate and unsupportive, making his life difficult.
Tristan became more and more isolated. He had lengthy stays in psychiatric units. He didn't belong anywhere.
In its final report, the Disability Royal Commission recommended the phasing out of group homes. It's a tough topic, particularly for people and families who have found a good one. It'll be one of the many issues discussed at a disability-focused conference starting today. Among the presenters is Professor Christine Bigby from La Trobe University. She's researched group homes for years.
The problem is not necessarily the size or the model. The problem is the quality of the support that people living in group homes received. We have a really unskilled workforce. We don't have any mandatory training or qualifications for frontline workers. They don't get good supervision and practice leadership.
Professor Bigby acknowledges the issue of residents not choosing who they live with and where they live has been a problem.
People only got into a group home because there was a crisis in their family home or in their other sort of accommodation. So people got moved to the only vacancies that were available, but ended up with some real mismatched households.
She says accommodation services have worked to improve housemate matching processes, and she's supportive of families that have managed to find smaller, individualised housing options. But she says it's vital to remember people with profound intellectual disability make up the majority of the estimated 20,000 residents in group homes, and not all of them have families to advocate on their behalf.
The people that have got left behind, the forgotten group of people, are those without strong family networks who have been able to use the advantages of individualised funding and the NDIS to build new alternatives.
Thanks to the NDIS, Diane Hilda's son Tristan has been in his own home with a rotation of professionally trained support workers for 7 years. She hopes others like him can one day be as settled as he is.
Today he lives a life of freedom, of choice. He's happy, and we're so happy that he has a life that he lives today.
Mother Diana Hilder, ending that report by Naz Campanella. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's not the first time terrorists have attacked a concert, and it happened again on Moscow's outskirts on Friday night as hundreds of people gathered for a sold-out rock gig. So what do we know of the Islamic State group that's claimed responsibility? And could the major security lapse see more Russians doubt Vladimir Putin's leadership? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.